Have you ever experienced precognition, perceiving an event that later comes to pass? How about precognitive dreams? You might remember the hit movie The Minority Report, that Steven Spielberg film starring Tom Cruise, based on a short story by Philip K. Dick, who likely knew plenty about precognition, including precog dreams. And in that film, there were three precogs who floated around in a dream state in like a tank of water and were able to predict future crimes. A great premise for a film, but also a description of what has been experienced and reported by people all over the world, many of them probably listening right now. Eric Wargo was our guest a while back talking about his book, Time Loops, and sort of he's been studying precognitive dreams, precognition in general since then. And it was a mind bender of a discussion the last time he heard about how time flows, not only in one direction. And we're in for more from Eric, bending our brains a little bit with his newest book, Precognitive Dreamwork and the Long Self. Those of you out there who've had precognitive dreams, things that came true after you dreamed them while you were sleeping, please stick around because I want to ask some of you to call in a little bit later. Eric Wargo joins us right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Eric Wargo has a PhD in anthropology from Emory University and works as a science writer and editor in Washington, D.C. In his spare time, he writes about science fiction, consciousness, and the paranormal at his popular blog, The Nightshirt. Time Loops was his first book. We had him on to talk about it a while ago, and he blew our minds, and he's back to do more of the same to discuss precognitive dream work and the long self, interpreting messages from your future. Eric, great to have you here.
Hello, George. Great to be back on Coast to Coast.
Well, this is a lot to absorb, so I'm just trying to figure out how the heck I can start this conversation because it takes some work to get one's head around what you've written here. But let's jump into the central premise, the idea that we all have the ability to have precognitive dreams. Talk about that in general.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not, you know, it's not even just an ability. It's a constant feature, I think, of our dreaming. I think we're always precognitive dreaming, and we're just not aware of it. And so, my new book is about how precognition works, how it works in dreams, and how people can experience it, can awaken to the fact that they are receiving messages from their future. Literally on a nightly basis, I think. And it's there are some pretty easy steps that anyone can take to discover this in their own lives.
We're going to go through some of those. You address right off the bat the position of skeptics, that they would argue that the mind, biased by hindsight, as you write, and the eternal search for meaning would find patterns in random noise. So we have a dream. Later, we think that it's something that's coming true, when actually our brain is just putting together random facts that don't really have anything to do with each other. What do you say to them?
Yeah, well, that's been the argument for actually for centuries against the idea of precognitive dreams. Skeptics don't like the idea, and we can talk about why they don't like the idea. But it's just not true. People who actually write and record their dreams, and this is the first step, really, in precognitive dream work. You need to write your dreams down. And when you do that, it becomes unmistakable. Then when a subsequent experience happens that closely matches what you've written, you can no longer argue that, my memory of that dream was distorted, or I'm altering my memory of that dream to fit the later event. It becomes quite clear that we really are dreaming about events in our future, but people just don't, people have not systematically paid attention to it, partly because of those skeptics that just tell you right off the bat, no, that's impossible. So people aren't even aware of this phenomenon for the most part. But it's, the skeptics' arguments really go out right out the window when you start doing precognitive dream work and examining it in your own life, and you start comparing your dreams to other people's precognitive dreams. You start to see that there are patterns and that there are consistencies between them. So I think this is a real phenomenon, and it's awaiting a scientific description by some bold bold scientist who's willing to step out of line and accept the reality and study it, you know, seriously, rather than just try to debunk it.
You take it head on pretty early in the book, where you say, look, the argument of debunkers essentially is it can't be, therefore it isn't. That's already been debunked, which it hasn't. And then the idea that it goes against science because it violates our assumptions of reality, that itself, you say, violates science, right? It's contrary to science.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, the scientific attitude is being open to new experiences and to open to new phenomena and try and understand them and try and test them and study them. And so anytime that there's a dogmatic stance that something cannot exist, that's not a scientific attitude.
What I always like about your books is you tie in popular culture, movies, books, things that people would relate to, that would remember, and work them into your theme in a very readable sense, as a dose of sugar to help the medicine go down of quantum physics and things of that sort that's a little harder to get our heads around. In this case, you start out with some really cool examples and very pointed examples of precognitive dreams that come true, but they're not always exactly true. They turn out to be different than maybe we imagine them in the dream state.
Yeah, this is one of the things that people need to understand that will help them detect precognitive dreams in their own life, is that precognitive dreams are almost never, you know, video quality representations of some event that's going to happen in their life. There are those dreams. There are dreams that's just like, wow, this is exactly what I dreamed. You know, you have experiences like, oh my God, I dreamed this exact scene. More often than not, they're distorted in subtle ways. Sometimes they're completely symbolic. And that's why people seldom actually make the connection between a dream and a later event, because their dreams are very often bizarre, symbolic. There may be a small element that's recognizable when the later event occurs, but if you do just a little bit of interpretation of those symbols, it's like the whole dream will then fall into place. You'll see that it was just a symbolic transformation of that later event. So most dreams are symbolic to a degree and distorted to a degree. So they're not exact, but they get enough details, you know, uncannily right, that it's quite, the precognition component is generally quite clear.
You have an example about a guy, I guess, since time loops and since your blog is so popular, people send you precognitive dreams all the time. So you get to pick some really good ones. But there's a guy, June 2019, a man in England named Thomas, who has a striking dream that his parents win £230,000 in a lottery. How did that turn out?
Yeah, exactly. That's a great example. So he dreams that his parents win this win a lottery of £230, but he can't. But the money is somehow inside of a milk bottle, and he can't reach his hand into the milk bottles to get the money. Okay, so he wakes up. The dream feels like really like, oh my God, this is precognitive somehow, or this is telling me that my parents need to buy a lottery ticket. So he gets on the phone with his dad, buy a lottery ticket this weekend. The next time he calls his mom, he asks about the lottery ticket, and the mom says, yeah, your dad bought the ticket, but we didn't win anything. And so he's kind of disappointed. Okay, I guess the dream didn't mean anything. Okay, then a week later, he talks to his mom again. He says, oh, by the way, your dad's cousin bought a lottery ticket and won £230,000. So this guy, you know, Thomas, you know, like, I knew it. I knew it. And then the mom explains, yeah, your dad's cousin was retired, so they really needed the money. And Thomas asked, well, what did he do for a living? And she says, oh, he was a milkman.
It's like the universe has a sense of humor.
Right. Well, but the dream was symbolically telling him about, a winning by a family member, wasn't his father, but it was his father's cousin, and that it wasn't accessible to him. You know, the dream was telling him that he couldn't get the money. It was not for him. Nevertheless, the dream is so precise that you can't chalk that up to random chance force fitting your memory to fit some event. So that's very typical of precognitive dreams. They're distorted in key ways. So it's very often hard to predict what's going to happen based on a dream. It's more often than not you're going to tell that a dream was precognitive and how it was precognitive in hindsight. That example is one of my favorites. I love that example. And I get a lot, you're right. I get emails almost every day from readers sharing their dream stories, and they're all like that.
We're going to talk extensively about the importance of keeping a dream journal, because as you note, and as everyone who's listening to this know, you don't remember them unless you make a pointed effort to write them down. You're going to wake up with little fragments that don't make much sense, and as the day goes on, you're going to forget all about them. But people who write them down have a better ability to make the connection. So there's an example you use in the book. It's a pretty important one about an astronomer named Paul Callas who was invested in the idea of keeping a dream journal, and it really paid off for him. Tell me that story.
Yeah, absolutely. I forget the exact year, I think it was in 2004. He made a very important discovery, which was of, and this was in a Hubble image of a star that he was studying, Fomalhaut. And the image taken by Hubble showed a very off-center debris ring around this star. The thing is, he remembered, I dreamed about this. And he went back into his dream journal. He happened to keep a dream diary, like a lot of people do. And he found that, I think it's exactly nine years earlier, almost to the day, he dreamed an image of a star that he was then studying with an off-center debris ring around it, and he drew it in his journal. It was almost exactly what the Hubble image showed. And this was an off-center debris ring was a weird, that was not something that was predicted by astronomers or known about. So this was, a totally new discovery. So he had dreamed this discovery 9 years beforehand, almost to the day, and that's actually an important fact we'll talk about later. Calendrical resonance is a very, very powerful thing in precognitive dreaming. But this discovery of his in 2004 then led to the discovery of the first photograph of an extrasolar planet using visible light, because that off-center debris ring enabled Paul Callas to predict that there would be a planet on that boundary of the debris ring, a very elliptical orbit of a planet. And so he was able to use that to take a photograph, an image that shows a planet in another solar system. That was the first photograph in visible light of a planet not in our solar system. So it was a very significant discovery, and he predicted it in a dream.
You put your money where your mouth is. You are, it's amazing the discipline that you have to write this stuff down, how long you've been doing it, and how often it pays off in a degree. So you started, and we're going to talk extensively about the importance of keeping a journal and how to do it and your suggestions for how people can do it. But you started this, what, and around the time that you were working on Time Loop?
No, I started a lot earlier. I've really been studying this about a decade at this point, a little over a decade. It was when I started studying ESP about a decade ago that, as part of that, I started paying more attention to my dreams. I had been keeping a dream journal actually for a few decades, since the early 90s. And I've been interested in dreams my whole life. I've, you know, done a lot of reading in psychoanalysis and Freud and Jung and different dream interpretive traditions. And so I knew a lot about dreams and the science of dreams. And, you know, I was very interested in the neuroscience of dreaming and more contemporary theories of how dreams work and so on. But I'd never taken seriously. I mean, I was a skeptic, you know, I was basically a skeptic at that point. I didn't really take seriously the idea that dreams could be precognitive, even though I had had a few examples of it myself, that I just kind of, you know, that's weird, but I just kind of booted it out of my memory because I didn't have, it just didn't make sense in terms of my worldview. But then about a decade ago, I started taking ESP seriously, doing a lot of reading, doing my due diligence, as I put it in the book, you know, reading the science. You know, there's a lot of science behind this. This is not just woo,
yeah,
as they'll call it. There's a lot of good science showing that ESP is real, particularly that precognition is real, and that got me to pay attention to some of the books that have been written in the past on precognitive dreams, particularly one pioneer in the study of precognitive dreams, whose name was John William Dunn, or J.W. Dunn, who was an aviation engineer writing about a century ago in England, who noticed that he often dreamed things that then later came to pass. And he was he had this real engineer's mindset, so he really wanted to understand how it worked. And so he wrote his dreams down, you know, number one, that's the number one step in precognitive dream work. And he did something else, which was, and this is step, what he would call step two in precognitive dream work, what I call step three. We'll talk about the second step later because it's a little more complicated. But this next step is you go back to your dream records every night. Before you go to bed, just go back to your dream records from the previous few days, two or three days, and just reflect on the dreams that you've had the previous few days and on what's happened in your life over those couple of days. Because it's that step that really people don't do. Even if they write their dreams down, they don't go back to their dream records from the last few days and think about connections. And what he did that, you know, boom, he was discovering all kinds of precognitive dreams. So I've meandered away from your original question, but
well, that's okay. That's all right. We got plenty of time. You know, I've had some success in being able to plant ideas in my brain to get some work done while I'm sleeping. You know, and I'll think about some story I have to write. I can't figure out how to get my head around it, and I'll wake up in the morning and it's pretty much laid out for me. Because I plant the seeds and it the work is done for me. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about here, where you're reflecting on your dreams at night before you go to sleep, sort of to set the stage for understanding what comes next?
No, actually, that's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is this: the reason you go through your dreams at night is so you can think about what has happened, like over the course of the day, and whether anything matched the dream you recorded that morning, and likewise from the previous couple of mornings. The point is to detect those connections between your waking life and your dreams. Because, like, if you record a dream in the morning, you know, there's no way of knowing it's precognitive.
I'll tell you, wait, hold on here, Eric. I asked that question at the wrong time. We'll pick this up on the other side. Talking with Eric Wargo, you know, the stories that most often surface, that the ones that the rest of us hear about precognitive dreams, are those involving calamitous events. You know, hundreds of people, maybe thousands of people, had precognitive dreams, images about the tragic events of 9/11. Some of them were right on the money, others were accurate, but not really literal, including Eric Wargo's own dreams about that event. Are we more likely to have visions of dramatic, tragic events, like the sinking of the Titanic, an airliner crash, something like that? We're going to hear about that in our next segment. Stick around. Eric, in your book, You write that many people report having dreams that come true, 17% to 38% in some surveys. Can you talk about how common it is? And is it more likely that the number is higher in reality because so many of us don't write them down, don't pay attention?
Yeah, absolutely. Those figures are people who, you know, are paying attention, you know. But most people don't write their dreams down. Most people don't even have a concept that their dreams may be precognitive, so they're not even looking for it. Those figures are people who, you know, for one reason or another, happen to notice, you know, because they're paying attention. but most dreams don't seize our attention. That's why you do need to put a little work into writing your dreams down and doing that other step that we talked about briefly earlier, which is going back to your dream records later to sort of compare things happening in your life and your own experiences to your recent dreams, because that's the key that's going to help you notice that you're having these things really very frequently. And so, yeah, I think that I honestly think that most dreams or many dreams could be precognitive. I think, you know, my working presumption is that all dreams are precognitive until proven otherwise. And you'll find if you start doing precognitive dream work, you're going to start hitting pay dirt, you know, very quickly.
And for those who pay attention to it, I mean, you have an example in the book where there's a guy who, when he realizes he has this power, it's like having a superpower. It's a guy who says, I'm like the X-Men. I can see into my own future a little bit. And he's looking for ways to harness this power, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the feeling that you have when your first, you know, really clear precognitive dream hit. It's exhilarating. And it feels like, holy crap, you know, I'm a lot more than I thought I was. My brain or whatever is reaching into the future. And that's pretty mind-blowing stuff.
You write, and it's sprinkled throughout the book, about calamitous events like 9/11 and how often people have precog dreams about some big events like that. And although that gets attention, you see an occasional newspaper story about people who saw the towers coming down, and you had your own dream that I want to hear about. They're not necessarily more common than just everyday kind of mundane sort of things that happen to turn out to be true, right?
Absolutely, yeah. This is an important thing. If you read a typical book about ESP or whatever, you're going to read those examples of people dreaming about big events like 9/11 or like the Titanic is another good example, or assassinations, things like that. Plane crashes, very common. But those are the ones that get reported. You know, no one's going to, you know, go calling a reporter, you know, because I had a dream about my sink backing up and it came true. You know, that's a much more common kind of dream. I think that premonitions of disaster and death, while those are really interesting to study and think about, they're really in the minority. Most dreams are about, you know, thankfully, most of our lives are pretty dull. You know, we're not exciting, and we're not in the thick of disaster and doom and death for the most part. You know, and thus our dreams are focusing on the upheavals in our lives that are, you know, objectively pretty small compared to things like, you know, plane crashes. We dream about things that matter to us emotionally, and that can be, you know, an embarrassing situation at work, or a sink backing up, or some, you know, really interesting article on the internet, or some really or reconnecting with an old friend, or seeing an unusual animal, or something like that. That's the kind of thing that we more typically have precognitive dreams about. But they're not the kinds of things that make it into ESP books usually.
9/11, I mean, there are some pretty remarkable precognitive images and dreams that people had about that. Talk about yours. You had a sort of a distorted kind of a version of it, but it proved to be amazingly prescient.
Right. Well, on the morning of 9/11, I was I had just moved a week earlier to Washington, D.C., and I had just started a job as an editor at a nonprofit in Washington, D.C. And anyway, so I woke up, I don't know, it was probably around 6 o'clock in the morning, and I jotted down, you know, I was in the habit of writing down everything I could remember about all my dreams every night. That morning, I just could remember a small dream. I wrote down basically one paragraph about this dream. And I was in the dream. I was driving down a street near where I grew up in Lakewood, Colorado as a child. Okay. And along the side of the street, there were two identical, perfectly square buildings with like these sort of corrugated gray facades, okay, very drab, perfectly square, and a pair of them, okay? And somehow in the dream, I thought they were mosques, okay? And basically and there was a further, then farther down the street, there was another one. There was another building just like that. Okay, so that was basically the whole dream, and I wrote it down. It didn't mean anything to me. Later that morning, a couple hours later, the events we all know occurred. I didn't even think about my dream. And it wasn't, I think, until the next day I looked at my dream record and saw, oh, that was weird. Because the buildings in my dream were not tall towers. The facades were exactly like the Twin Towers. I mean, they were like just shortened versions of the Twin Towers. And, you know, that they were mosques was weird, too, you know. But when I free associated, now this free association, like put an asterisk by that, because that's the second step, second important step in precognitive dream work. But I was in the habit already of free associating on my dreams, which is what Freud recommended, you know, over a century ago, which is just think, what's the first thing this reminds me of? Well, that free associating on the dream revealed some further connections. The location of those mosques in my dream. In reality, there is a building on that street, and it's still there, where my father, when I was a child, for a brief period of time, had his psychological practice in that office building. And my single memory connected to that office building and to that time of my dad's life was when he had to go to the office late at night to counsel a patient who was on the brink of suicide. And he told me and my mom this the next morning. It was a very powerful memory for me. So I have a very powerful association between that building and suicide. Okay. Now in the dream, that building was replaced by these mosques that looked just like the towers of the World Trade Center. So I had an association with that dream location of suicide. Okay, so you know, you combine these things, suicide, Islam with the mosques and the appearance of the buildings. I mean, it was you know, I think this dream was very clearly precognitive, but it wasn't like a typical premonition that you'd read about, a dream of, you know, planes crashing into buildings or something fiery and calamitous. But it's a dream that distinctly connected to the themes of the day that followed the dream. And most precognitive dreams are of that nature. They're distorted and they're symbolic representations of experiences to come in our lives, but not direct sort of video quality previews.
Jumping ahead to later in the book, I don't want to give too much all of it away, but you write that these precognitive dreams, and I want to have you tell us about how well documented they are. It's not just somebody making it up later that they knew they predicted it, but how accurate they really were, and how many of them there were. But the idea that they're not people necessarily predicting calamitous events, earth-shattering events, they're predicting their own emotional reaction to those events.
Exactly. Yes, this is a very key point, and this is something that was discovered by that pioneer that I mentioned earlier, J.W. Dunn, over a century ago, he very quickly discovered, when he started studying his dreams scientifically, that he was not dreaming about objective events in the world. He was dreaming about his own learning about those events and his own emotional reactions to them. And he could tell, and the way he told he could determine this was very brilliant. Whenever there's a discrepancy between a real event and the way it's reported in the news, his dream always matched the latter. Okay, his dream always matched the news story, even if it was erroneous, rather than the actual event. And he discovered this in a couple of cases, which he wrote about in a book called An Experiment with Time. That was a key discovery, probably the most important discovery, I think, in the science of dream precognition, was that dreams are about our own experiences and our own learning experiences too. They're often about reading experiences and things that we see on the news or things that we read on the internet, but they're not about those events happening at a distance.
So you are, for 9/11, you're in essence having a precognitive image of how devastated you feel when you read that story about 9/11 in the newspaper or see it on television, and how you
Absolutely,
react in the future.
Yes.
It's a glimpse of your own future.
Exactly.
How impressed are you by the documentation about people with the 9/11 example, staying on that, that they're not just making it up to seem like they're psychics, but they really did have these images in their dreams, wrote them down before the events happened, and then were able to revisit it?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing is, most people don't write their dreams down. So more often than not, accounts of dream precognition are after the fact, unfortunately. And so that naturally holds no weight with scientists. Okay. But that's no basis from which to then debunk those stories either, because, very few people write their dreams down. Does that negate the fact that they probably did have precognitive dreams? I know from my own experience studying this for a decade now, and from, collecting dreams from, many, many, many other dreamers, reading the literature, that it's a real phenomenon, and we should stop just debunking people's stories or discounting people's stories just because they may have written their dreams down afterwards. Enough people write their dreams down beforehand, as you say, that you can say, yes, this is a real phenomenon. They're really doing it. This idea that people say they have precognitive dreams just to get famous as a psychic or something like that, that's just, preposterous. I mean, who does that?
Right.
I mean,
So you're an anthropologist. Can you give me a broad stroke explanation of how this stacks up in history? Culturally, is it the kind of thing that pops up in literature from centuries gone by? Has it always been around?
Yes, absolutely. And every culture in the world, except for ours, is pretty much the only culture that doesn't officially, recognize precognitive dreaming. Every other culture, it's just taken for granted that at least some dreams tell us about the future or about future events or future experiences of the dreamer. That's just basic across cultures and throughout history. Now, ours is an exception. And why is it an exception? That's an interesting, there's an interesting story there, I think, that we can talk about if you'd like.
Goes
back to the Enlightenment. Yeah. Okay, sure. Well, three centuries ago, roughly, the time of, Isaac Newton and those guys who are really trying to put science on a firm footing. Okay, this was sort of the beginnings of science as we now understand it. It was very important to not let the divine into your explanations of physical phenomena. Okay, and these guys were believers, but they didn't think that it was fair to let divine intervention play a role in our scientific explanation for causality. Okay, so one of the tenets of causality, as it was kind of formulated, was that effects cannot precede causes. Okay, so things go in a single direction, and in the physical world that we interact with on a daily basis, that seems to be the case. I mean, causes, there does seem to be an arrow of time, okay, that flows in a single direction. And given that, it was the early, the scientists of the Enlightenment were resolute that, you can't have an effect before a cause. And that's the kind of thing that a precognitive dream would be. So it just became forbidden, essentially, to talk about these anomalies that got lumped under the sort of category of psychical phenomena or whatever, and they were doing it in good faith. I mean, they wanted to explain the world, and we have all of the scientific advances of our world to we have them to thank for all the science that now makes our lives so much better than they were for people centuries ago. But quantum physics for a century has suggested that maybe that one way arrow of time isn't the whole truth, and it's now becoming acceptable to a lot of physicists that, in fact, retrocausality may be a reality on the quantum level, that is to say the smallest scales of particles interacting with each other, and that those retrocausal phenomena might scale up in certain contexts, such as quantum computers and other special situations. Well, guess what organ is thought by many people now to be a quantum computer? Okay, the brain.
Yeah, brain.
There's all kinds of reasons why the notion of precognition is starting to seem less and less like some divine intervention or something beyond scientific rationality. It's starting to seem more and more plausible on a totally physical, scientific level.
Well, it raises uncomfortable big questions, such as about free will and destiny, whether things are already written down or not. We're going to get into that in our next segment with Eric Wargo and do a little how-to, a list of suggestions for you about how our listeners are able to better tune into their own dreams and figure out what might be coming next down the road. We'll be right back with more